How do you know you've met God? I remember a time where I was spending a lot of time in London, the city of London in the UK, and I met so many different kinds of people from so many different cultures. And at one interaction particularly sticks in my mind. I was near a big mall. It was called the Westfield Mall. And we were doing evangelism. And this guy came up to me, long hair, beard, and I asked him about Jesus. And he said, "Oh, I am God." I'm thinking, wow, okay, apparently God wears a tie-dye shirt. He said, "I'm God. We're all God. We all have divinity within us." That was one response that I got. Many other responses. I talked to a lot of Muslims, and they said, "Met God? My job is to obey God, not to meet God. He is far too holy for me to meet God." I met Sikhs, I met Hindus, I met secular people, I met agnostics. Every person had a different idea of what it would be like to meet God, or even if that was particularly possible at all. Let me ask you that question this morning. How do you know that you've met the real God? You know, if everything is just our subjective experience, how can we know? Well, actually, this passage in Exodus is going to show us how you can know and how you can have certainty that you have met the real God. How you know, actually, that you have been redeemed and that you have been saved and that you've been called out of darkness into light. I remember there was a period when I was a teenager that I really struggled, having grown up in the church, thinking, well, I grew up in the church. Have I really been saved? How do I know that I'm a Christian? How do I know that God is really at work in my life? And this passage really, really helped me, because this passage explodes a lot of the convenient hallmark myths that we hold about God. It's actually going to show us who this God of our salvation and our redemption is. And we're going to see two major things this morning. We're going to see first where Moses meets God, and then secondly, who this God is. Where Moses meets God, and who this God is. So the first thing to notice here in our passage, and it kind of begins in chapter 3, but it's been going on since the second half of chapter 2, is this. Moses is on a detour. He's on a detour. What does the text say in chapter 3, verse 1? Moses led his flock to the west side of the wilderness. Actually, it's a little more direct in Hebrew, which says that he literally brings his flock behind the wilderness, or the backside of the wilderness. See, Moses at the moment is in the back of beyond. He is in the middle of podunk nowhere. It's not even in a one-horse town. There are no horses in this town. He is in the middle of nowhere. But he's not just on a detour from his normal shepherding route. He doesn't just decide to take his flock out of his normal pathway. His whole life is on a significant detour. Think about what Moses was trained to do. He was trained in the household of Pharaoh. He was at the center of the seat of power. He was trained to be a ruler of men and of people and of nations, on one of the most powerful nations on earth. But now what is he doing? He is leading sheep, employed by his father-in-law, in the middle of nowhere. How far he has fallen. How far off track has his life gotten? But you see, it's this very detour that God uses to bring him where? Where? Well, we're told. To Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, some of you may know this, but there's a different name for Horeb. Do you know what that name is? Sinai. He's in the back of beyond, and yet he has come to the mountain. If you know anything about the Bible, you will know that this mountain is the mountain. It's the place where God is going to descend in fire and glory and give his people the law, and the whole mountain is going to shake with his presence. It's where God chooses to reveal himself to his people. This is the mountain. And it is in the middle of nowhere. So let's put those two things together. Moses is in the middle of nowhere, and yet he's come to the mountain of God. See, Moses is as far off track as it gets. Not just professionally, but personally. He is on a huge detour, and yet he has come near to God. He's in the middle of nowhere, and yet he's on spiritual Main Street. See, it might look to us and to him like his life is in a shambles. It is not what he planned. 40 years in the wilderness, but he is exactly where God wants him to be. He's exactly in the right place to meet with God. I wonder, are you on a detour? Has 2020 felt like a huge detour? Have there been plans that you've had that haven't worked? Maybe it's even beyond 2020. Maybe you're in a period of life, whether it's in a relationship with someone or whether it's professionally. Whether there are maybe lots of things that make you feel like you are on a detour. Maybe you feel like you are in the wilderness, like you're in the backside of beyond, like you're in a one-horse town. Doesn't this passage tell us initially to tread carefully? Because you may be very near to God. If you feel like you're in a wilderness place, you may be just about to meet the real God. And in this, the midst of this 40-year detour that Moses has taken, we're told in verse 3, Moses turns aside. He turns aside. See, even though Moses is off the beaten track of his life and he's off the beaten track of his usual journey, he's on the road less traveled, he still has to take the time and he still has to make the choice to turn aside. He has to take the choice to stop, to probably leave his flock, and to go and see this sight that he's about to see. Now, I don't think Moses turns aside here in chapter 3 because he's merely interested. I don't think he's merely curious. What does he say? I will turn aside to see this great sight. He doesn't just say, oh, that's interesting, and then carries on. He says, I'm going to turn aside because this is a great sight that I'm seeing. There's something arresting about it. There's something attractive about it. It's a wonder to him. You see, I think Moses here is experiencing something that he doesn't have an explanation for. He's experiencing something that doesn't fit with his current worldview. He's experiencing something that he doesn't have the resources to explain. It's outside of his understanding of reality. It's a paradigm challenger. It's a worldview challenger, which I think prompts us to ask whether we're taking the time to turn aside on our wilderness detours. Now, many of us will just grumble along until we arrive where we want to be. But are you taking the time to turn aside on your wilderness detours? You know, I was preparing this week, and I was wondering how a marbleheader would respond to a burning bush. That's interesting. Kind of worried about what that's going to do to the housing prices around here. Anyway, off to the yacht club. You know, I wonder if that's how they would respond. But listen, do you know a burning bush when you see one? Are you able to spot it? You know, is there something in your life that doesn't make sense to you? Is there something in your life which is challenging your worldview? Do you know a burning bush when you see one? Do you know when it's time to take the time to turn aside on your wilderness journey? You know, I think it's so hard for us to call that. It's so hard for us to understand and see know a burning bush when we see one, because we live in an age of curated social media feeds. We live in our own sort of personal electronic echo chambers where nothing is ever challenged and where everything we believe currently is reinforced. You know, are you experiencing something that forces you to think outside the box? Are you experiencing something that doesn't fit with your current understanding of the world? You know, it could be retirement. Right? It could be struggling with that. It could be the disappointment that comes with success. It could be the transition between high school and college. It could be the end of a very strange school year. It could be being far from home and longing to be home. It could be a wayward loved one. See, there are so many burning bushes. There are so many things that we need to take the time to turn aside and consider and look at. Let me ask you, what is your wilderness? What is your burning bush? What's your detour? I want you to think about that this morning. I want you to think about that this week. And once you've identified them, turn aside. Stop. Take time. Think. Read scripture. Pray. Reflect. Talk to other Christians about it. You need to take time to turn aside, because it's often on the detours that God is near. That is something that is so clearly taught here at the beginning of chapter 3, and actually has been taught through the second half of chapter 2. When you're on a detour, just like Moses is, God is near. You might feel like you're in obscurity. You might be on spiritual Main Street. You might be near the mountain of God. So we've seen that Moses is in the middle of nowhere. But even in the middle of nowhere, he's not far from God. Even though he's gotten seriously off of track, he's about to have one of the most defining experiences of his entire existence. And God draws near to him. But there's a huge question here. Who is this God that draws near? How are we to understand who it is? Once we've turned aside, how are we to know that we've really met the real God? Well, I think there's two elements to this. There's a flame and there's a name. We're going to look at the flame and the name. These two things that show us that we've met the real God. So Moses turns aside in the rest of this chapter, and what does he see? Fire. He sees fire. I wonder if you've ever wondered, well, why is it fire? Why that particular element? Why does God choose to manifest himself in fire in a bush? That seems a little strange. I don't know if that's what you would have chosen if you were writing the Bible. Would it have been a fiery bush? I'm not sure it would have if I was doing that. But it's fire. And actually, if you look at all the times God appears in the Bible, you'll see fire is all over the place. Just trace the imagery of fire just through the book of Exodus, and it's a really rich experience because you have it here in the burning bush. You have the pillars of fire and cloud that lead the people through the wilderness and out through the Red Sea. You have fire at Sinai. You have the cloud filling the tabernacle, which is concealing the fire of God. Fire is all over the place. But I think it's more than that. It's more than just a convenient metaphor. See, fire is used here because I think fire is both attractive and it's dangerous. It draws us to it, but it's deadly to us if we misuse it. It both fascinates and repels. We can't shape fire. We can use it, we can't shape it, and it has a life of its own. And if we're not careful, fire will consume us. It will kill us. It will destroy us. It will disintegrate us. It will injure us. I always remember growing up in the UK, going to Guy Fawkes Night. You know, we'd all come together as the neighborhood. We'd have this massive bonfire, and we'd have this effigy of Guy Fawkes. If you don't know who that is, Google it or ask me afterwards. We'd have this effigy of Guy Fawkes that we would burn, and we would have treats and snacks, and we'd barbecue, and it would be great fun. But I'd always remember in this roaring bonfire, I'd want to approach it. Because there's something attractive about the flickering, changing, effervescent light that is there in the fire. But I would always be warned by my parents, don't get close to that fire, because if you do, you'll catch fire, and we don't want to have to put you out. Loving parents. That's not actually what they said, but that's what it felt like. But I would remember, I would get close to this fire. And if you've ever spent any time close to a fire, you can only spend so much time close to it before you have to take a step away, because the heat gets too intense. You know, I would have cats at home that would love to sit near our hearth and our fireplace, and they would warm their backs by the fire, but eventually it would get too much for them, especially our black cat who would absorb heat like nobody's business, and they'd have to run away eventually. I remember going to Montana and sitting in front of a bonfire there in the summer, and it got too hot, so I had to step back. That is what it's being gotten at here. You have to move away sometimes from the fire. And you can see this duality in the fact that Moses is fascinated and he turns aside. But when God sees Moses drawing near, he says in verse 5 this, "Don't come near. Take your sandals from upon your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And again, here actually the Hebrews are a little more blunt. You know what God says? Stop. No further. That's literally what God says. It's a little more blunt. We see Moses is already in the fatal zone. He's turned aside on his detour, and he doesn't know it, but he's in dangerous territory because he's about to come into contact with the fundamental reality of everything. He's about to come into contact with the one who breathes out stars, who speaks and light happens. He is already in the fatal zone. Now, actually, Moses taking off his sandals is not just a courtesy. In that era, taking off your sandals from your feet is an act of worship and reverence. Actually, you still see that when Muslims go into the mosque. They take off their shoes from their feet because it's an act of reverence and respect and worship. And if you read on, you'll see that Moses hides his face in fear. Do you see what this is saying? The fire, the flame, and the warning are showing us that God is holy. God is holy. He's not to be trifled with. That's one of the first ways that you can know that you've met the real God. You have an experience of holiness. Now, that word holiness comes with a lot of baggage. And you've probably heard that word holiness before, probably many times if you've been circulating in Christian circles or around the church, or even if you haven't, you've probably heard that word a lot. But we tend to associate that word holy with things that are not that positive. And that's not what this passage is getting at. When we think of someone as holy, we tend to think of them as holier than thou. We tend to think of them as kind of stuck up and kind of judgmental and not really much fun to be around. Oh yeah, I've got an uncle that's kind of holy. I don't want to invite him to any of the family barbecues. Right? That's not what this passage is talking about. That's not what the Bible means about holiness, and you need to understand this. To be holy literally means to be set apart. It really means to be unique. It means to be in a league of your own. It's not just moral purity. It's absolute otherness. Actually, the theological word for holiness is transcendence. The word transcendence means to be so far above something that it is unapproachable and unreachable. It's talking about God's otherness. You know, I think a helpful way to understand this is if you think about the sun at the center of our solar system. We need the sun for light and warmth, and things grow when they have the benefit of the light of the sun. But the closer we get to it, the deadlier it becomes, the more the radiation from the sun affects us. You know, as the closer we get to the sun, the more its gravity pulls us into its orbit, and the even more dangerous it becomes. Yes, the sun holds our planets in their orbit around itself, but were they to get any closer, we would be drawn in and destroyed. See, even now, if we spend too much time in the sun's unfiltered rays, we will burn our skin and we'll have a lot of problems. That's not just a public health announcement for the nice weather outside, by the way. That is getting at God's holiness, the holiness of God. He draws you near, but if you get too close, it's dangerous. He's holy. Do you see the dilemma? Just like the sun, the dilemma is that we need God. We need God like we need the light of the sun for warmth and life and everything. But his holiness is actively dangerous to us. That's why Moses is afraid. Have you had an experience of fear and awe at God? That is one sign that you have met the real God. Because his holiness is a threat. Before his holiness becomes beautiful to you, you've got to realize that firstly, it's a threat to a fallen human being. Let's think about the story in Genesis. When God casts Adam and Eve out of the garden, what does he put in between them and him? A flaming sword. A flaming sword. Did you ever think about that? There's a flaming sword between fallen humanity and a holy God at the entrance to Eden. You know, it's also why on the Day of Atonement, in the rest of the Old Testament, the high priest, as he goes into the Holy of Holies, into the presence of God, he'd have a cord tied around his ankle so that if he died in the presence of God, his fellows wouldn't have to go in and retrieve his body. They could just pull him out. God is holy. He's not to be trifled with. That is what is being said here. It shows us that the holiness of God is the one thing that is barring us from coming back into his presence. And it shows us that when we meet God, there's a come close, stay away element to it. Have you realized that paradox? What does God say? He says, Moses. Moses. When someone's name is repeated twice in Hebrew, it shows intimacy. It shows affection. He knows Moses' name, and he's calling him intimately. He's drawing him in, but then he also says, stay away. God is calling him close, but he's cautioning him. There's a call and a caution in the flame. The flame attracts us, but it repels us. We've got to understand that call and caution. You and I must not treat God lightly when we come to him. Yes, we have wonderful access to him as Christians. His throne is a throne of grace, not a throne of judgment. It's a throne of mercy and help in time of need, but he is still holy. When you come to church, when you come to prayer, when you come to read the scriptures, do you understand that you are coming before a holy God? Do not trifle with him. Treat him familiarly, but don't treat him lightly. He says to us, I'm calling you, but I am not a curiosity. I'm not an abstract concept to be studied. I am a holy person. Do not take him lightly. We need to take him seriously. He's not to be trifled with. That's what the flame shows us. But I realize all this talk of God's holiness, his transcendence, his otherness might seem to make him look distant. or even in a sense unapproachable. And I know that's been a lot of people's experience of church. That's been a lot of people's experiences of this. We've all had churches where they've emphasized the holiness of God at the expense of the love and the personality and the personhood and the name of God. Many of us have had that experience. But there's another crucial side to this story, and its marks are everywhere. You see, God has a name. Just like I have a name, just like my name is Will, just like Tyler's name is Tyler, God has a name, and it's Yahweh. And because he has a name, that means he's personal. And because he has a name, it means he can be personally known. Have you ever made that connection? You know, the most important thing to learn about someone is their name. Attached to their name is their history, which we're going to see. Attached to their name is their personality. Attached to their name are the memories that you have of them. To know someone's name is to enter into relationship with that person. Yes, God is holy, but he also has a name. And you can actually see that here in the use of all of the I pronouns. They're all over the place. And actually, they're pretty emphatic in Hebrew. God says in verse 6, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In verse 7, I have surely seen, I have heard, I know, verse 8. I have come down, verse 9, again, I have seen, verse 10, I will send, verse 12, I will be with you. Imagine you're Moses at this point. It leads Moses to ask this classic question, well, who are you? You're using I all the time. Who is this I that is going to be sending me to Pharaoh? I don't know your name. Who are you? And here we have perhaps the most famous saying in the entire Bible. I am who I am. I'm sorry, that gives me chills when I hear that. I will be who I will be. That's what comes out of this burning bush. And then this I will be who I will be gets turned into I am. And then later on it gets turned into God's personal name, Yahweh. And because he has a name, he can be known. But notice what God doesn't say. He doesn't say, Moses, I am who you want. He doesn't say, who do you think I am? What would work for you? What's going to fit with your schedule? He says, I am who I am. Now imagine if you wanted to get to know me, and you said to me, now Will, I know that you're a pastor from England who enjoys music, who loves Star Wars, but you know, I think I prefer to think of you as a middle-aged Greek car mechanic from Queens. I think that would really fit my image of you. That's how I like to think about you. And I would probably say to you, hey, it's a free country. You can believe what you want to believe. If that's convenient for you, that's fine. But that's not at all the reality of who I am. And I don't think we can really have a relationship. It's unlikely we can have a meaningful relationship if you continue to think of me in that way. But don't we do the same thing with God all the time? Listen, is he I am who I am to you? Or is he I am who you want? You need to ask yourself that question. You know, are you editing out of your relationship with God the things that make you uncomfortable? Let me just list some things. I'm talking about God's views on justice, or racial equality, or the poor, or immigrants on one hand. Or is it his views on human sexuality, or the definition of marriage, or the sanctity of life on the other hand? Is there something that you are editing out of God's I am who I am, his right to define himself and for him to define his values? Is he I am who I am to you, or is he I am who you want? If there's nothing about the I am that makes you uncomfortable, then you may not have met the real God yet. If nothing in Scripture arrests you, makes you turn aside, is inexplicable to you, if God fits into your box, then he is I am who you want and not I am who I am. And by the way, if he is I am who you want, he's not I am who you need. The only God you need is the God who declares himself I am who I am. I will be who I will be. I get to define who I am, not you. Have you met the real personal God yet? Or are you editing things out of your relationship to him? And you see, yet despite this warning, there is deep encouragement here. See, God names himself as Yahweh, but he repeats twice in this passage, I am the God of Abraham, I am the God of Isaac, And I am the God of Jacob. And twinned with his I will be who I will be. And the fact that he promises Moses to be with him means that God is the God of the covenant. Did you notice that? He is the God of a covenant relationship. He makes promises to his people. He binds himself by oath to fulfill what he has promised to them in generations past. See, even though God is I am who I am, even though he reserves the right to define himself, to declare who he is, he chooses to bind himself to promises. He chooses to define himself by his relationship to his people. Isn't that a wonderful thing? God could have chosen just to remain distant. He could have just said, I am who I am, deal with it. But he says, no, I am who I am. And here's who I am, Moses. I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. I made promises to them, and I'm making a promise to you, and I'm binding myself by covenant oath to fulfill my promises. Let me get a little theological with you here. Because God is eternal, because he never changes, he can patiently fulfill his promises. That's what I think he means by I will be. I will be with you. What he's doing there is he's declaring his all-sufficiency to meet the needs of his people anywhere and everywhere and every when. There will never be a time where you can talk about God in the past tense. He is. And because that is true, there will never be a time where his presence is unavailable to you. There will never be a time where his name isn't near. That's why, even on a detour, Moses meets with God. He is I am who I am. He is sufficient to meet the needs of his people. He binds himself by covenant oath to keep those promises to his people. There will never be a time where Yahweh is unavailable to you or far from you. He will always keep his promises to you and for you because he is the I am who I am. So let me draw these two things together for us. I think there are two major errors you find in the world today when it comes to approaching God, even when it comes to churches. You find people who have a God that is holy, but not personal. And then you find others who have a personal God on the one hand, but not a holy one on the other. All right, the first kind of person has a God who is all distance and discipline and command and rules. And the second one has a God who is only affirming and loving and warm. So the first kind of person is proud when they're performing well morally. They look down on other people. They scoff at other people. They are judgmental of other people. And they are devastated when they break the rules and they fail and they go wrong. That's the first kind of person. See, the second kind of person, the one whose God is all love and warmth and light, never changes meaningfully. Because you cannot change meaningfully without being confronted. You cannot change meaningfully without being arrested by somebody who contradicts you. You cannot change meaningfully without discipline. See, neither have the full picture. You need a God who is holy, and you need a God who is personal. You need the flame, and you need the name. You need both of those things if you're to know that you have met the real God. Can I ask you a provocative question? Which are you more prone to falling into? Are you more prone to making God the I am who you want, who is all discipline and holiness? Or are you prone to making him the I am who you want, who is all affirmation and loving kindness? God is both of those things, but not separately. He is both of those things together. He is the flame and he's the name. There's a flame and a name. But as we close this morning, you might have realized that there's a mysterious part of the passage that I have left out until now. The very beginning of this account, it's not strictly God himself who appears in the bush. Did you see that? We're actually told it's the angel of the Lord who appears in the bush. Even at this point where Moses meets God, there has to be a mediator. There has to be somebody mediating the presence of God. See, this mysterious angel who is distinct from God and yet speaks for God. I wonder if you noticed that. Initially it says it's the angel of the Lord that calls, speaks to Moses. And yet in the rest of the chapter it says it's God who's speaking to Moses. Well, which one is it? It's both. There's a mediator here. He has the same authority and power as God does. He's the one who's present in the pillar of fire and cloud. It's God's angel who he sends out to destroy the Egyptians and destroy his enemies in the rest of the Old Testament. Trace this figure throughout the Old Testament and you will be in for real mystery. So how do you and I approach a personal and holy God? How do we hold those two contradictory things, paradoxical things together? What? How? Through a mediator. Just like Moses needs the angel of the Lord to draw near to the burning bush, you and I need a mediator to draw near to God. That's how a holy God can come into Moses' life and call him near. It's the angel of God that goes with his people, and it's through the angel that his glory can dwell in their midst. That's the final lesson of the burning bush. I think actually the burning bush is a metaphor for Moses' life. The bush is not consumed, and yet it is alive with the fire of God. By the way, if you're a Christian, that's a metaphor for your life as well. The holy God can come in and yet not consume us so that we too can become a burning bush. For us, on the other side of the cross, actually, it's Jesus who is the mediator. Jesus is the one who enables God's holy and yet beautifying presence to come into our lives. You know when Jesus is being confronted by the Pharisees and he says, "Before Abraham was, I am." Do you not think he has this in mind when he's saying that? Do you not think he is claiming to be the same mediator who mediates the presence of God to Abraham through the burning bush? He's claiming to be the same I am who spoke to Moses. Jesus is the one who embodies both the holiness and the intimacy and personhood of God. I mean, it doesn't get much more personal than becoming a human being, does it? Jesus is the one who embodies that intimacy of God and brings it into our lives. Jesus is both utterly holy and deeply personal, and magnetic, and attractive, and contradictory, and paradoxical, and arresting. That is who Jesus is. He's the angel. See, you don't need to be a mighty oak. You don't need to be a sequoia. You can just be a bush. You don't need to be anything great, because it's not the bush that makes it great. It's not the bush that makes it a great sight. It's the flame and the presence of God that is inexplicably not consuming this bush that makes it a great size. See, if the presence of God has come into your life, you may just be a bush, but there will be something inexplicable about you. There'll be something attractive about you. There'll be something magnetic about you that draws people near. Have you met people like that? We've all met people who it feels like it's just being like with Jesus with them. See, without the discipline of holiness, you'll never change. And without the love of a personal God, you will never be secure in that change. But with this God, and with the mediator Jesus Christ, with the angel of the Lord, you too will become beautiful and explicable and inexplicable. And people will be drawn to you, and people will turn aside on their detours to see you. Do you have anyone in your life that you know is on a detour? Maybe they need to turn aside and see you and see God's presence in your life. Think about that. Pray about that. Fall in love with God again. Turn aside. Because he is the great I am. So let me leave you with this. Are you going to respond like Moses did? See how Moses responds? When God calls him, "Moses, Moses," what does Moses say? "Here I am." Literally in Hebrew, that means, "Behold me. I am at your service." This morning, as we transition into a time of prayer and singing and responding to this, are you going to respond to God this morning? "Here I am." Christian, maybe you feel like you're on a detour and you feel far from God. Maybe you this morning need to say to God, "Here I am." Maybe you're not a Christian this morning and you know you're on a detour and there's something about this God that arrests you and you want to explore more. Will you say to him this morning, "Here I am"? When God calls you, the only logical, rational response is either to flee in terror or to throw your sword at his feet and say, "Command me. Here I am. Behold me." Will you return with that this morning? Will you say to him, will you say to the I am, "Here I am"? Let's pray. Lord, thank you that even if we're on a detour, and even if things aren't going to plan, we might be near to you. Help us to know that you're both holy and personal. And help us to turn aside to see you, and may other people in our lives turn aside to see us as your presence burns within us. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.